Part 3. Salinas 8. Chapter 37. October 30th, 1989. Kazakhstan, USSR. With a fireball brighter than the Siberian sun, Salinas 8 rose into a chilly blue sky, carrying the 110-ton manned lunar station. The super rocket and four strap-on boosters, generating 14 million pounds of thrust, threw out a tail of orange-yellow flame 1,000 feet long and 300 feet wide. White smoke burst around the launch pad, and the rumble from the engines rattled glass 12 miles away. At first it lifted so ponderously that it hardly seemed to be moving at all. Then it picked up speed and thundered skyward. Soviet President Antonov observed the liftoff from an armored glass bunker through a pair of large binoculars mounted on a tripod. Sergei Kornilov and General Yasenin stood beside him, intently monitoring voice communications between the cosmonauts and the Space Control Center.
"An inspiring sight," Antonov muttered in awe.
"A textbook launch," Kornilov said. "They'll reach escape velocity in 4 minutes."
"Does all go well?"
"Yes, Comrade President. All systems are functioning normally. And they are exactly on track." Antonov gazed at the long tongue of flame until it finally vanished. Only then did he sigh and step away from the binoculars.
"Well, gentlemen, this space spectacular should take the world's eyes off the next American shuttle flight to their new orbital station."
Yasenin nodded in agreement and gripped Kornilov's shoulder.
"My congratulations, Sergei. You stole the Yankee triumph for the Soviet Union."
"No brilliance on my part," said Kornilov. "Because of orbital mechanics, our lunar launch window happened to be open for an advantageous shot several hours ahead of their scheduled launch."
Antonov stared into the sky as if mesmerized. "I assume American intelligence isn't privy to the fact our cosmonauts are not what they seem."
"A flawless deception," Yasenin said without reservation. "The switch of 5 space scientists for specially trained soldiers shortly before liftoff went smoothly."
"I hope we can say the same about the crash program to replace test equipment with weapons," said Kornilov. "The scientists whose experiments were canceled nearly caused a riot. And the engineers, who were ordered to redesign the interior of the station to accommodate new weight factors and weapon storage requirements, became angry at not being told the reason behind the last-minute changes. Their displeasure will most certainly be leaked."
"Don't lose any sleep over it," Yasenin laughed. "The American space authorities will suspect nothing until communication with their precious moon base goes dead."
"Who is in command of our assault team?" asked Antonov.
"Major Grigory Luchenko, an expert on guerrilla warfare. The major won many victories against the rebels in Afghanistan. I can personally vouch for his qualities as a loyal and outstanding soldier."
Antonov nodded thoughtfully.
"A good choice, General. He should find the lunar surface little different from that of Afghanistan."
"There is no question that Major Luchenko will conduct a successful operation."
"You forget the American astronauts, General," said Kornilov.
"What about them?"
"The photographs demonstrate they have weapons, too. I pray they are not fanatics who will wage a strong fight to protect their facility."
Yasenin smiled indulgently.
"Pray, Sergei? Pray to whom? Certainly not to any god. He won't help the Americans once Luchenko and his men begin their attack. The outcome is a foregone conclusion. Scientists cannot stand up against professional soldiers trained to kill."
"Do not underrate them, that's all I have to say."
"Enough," Antonov said loudly. "I'll hear no more of this defeatist talk. Major Luchenko has the double advantage of surprise and superior weaponry. Less than 60 hours from now, the first real battle for space will begin. And I do not expect the Soviet Union to lose it." In Moscow, Vladimir Polovoy sat at his desk in the KGB Center on Dzerzhinsky Square, reading a report from General Velikov. He did not glance up as Lev Maisky strode into the room and sat down without an invitation. Maisky's face was common, blank, and one-dimensional like his personality. He was Polovoy's deputy head of the First Chief Directorate, the foreign operations arm of the KGB. Maisky's relations with Polovoy were restrained, but they complemented each other. Finally, Polovoy's eyes bored through Maisky. "I'd like an explanation." "For the Baron's presence was unforeseen," Maisky said tersely. "Mrs. LeBaron and her crew of treasure hunters, perhaps, but certainly not her husband. Why did Velikov take him from the Cubans?" "The general thought Raymond LeBaron might be a useful pawn in negotiations with the U.S. State Department after the Castros were removed." "His good intentions have made for a dangerous game," said Polovoy. "Velikov assures me that LeBaron is kept under strict security and fed false information." "Still, there is always a small chance LeBaron might discover the true function of Cayo Santa Maria." "Then he would simply be erased." "And Jesse LeBaron?" "My personal thoughts are that she and her friends will prove useful dupes in laying the blame for our projected disaster on the CIA's doorstep." "Has Velikov or our resident agents in Washington uncovered any plans by American intelligence to infiltrate the island?" "Negative," Maisky answered. "A check on the blimp's crew showed none have current ties with the CIA or the military." "I want no screw-ups," said Polovoy firmly. "We are too close to success. You pass my words on to Velikov." "He shall be instructed." There was a knock on the door, and Polovoy's secretary entered. Without a word, she handed him a paper and left the room. Sudden anger reddened Polovoy's face. "Damn! Speak of a threat, and it becomes a reality." "Sir?" "A priority signal from Velikov. One of the prisoners has escaped." Maisky made a nervous movement with his hands. "It is impossible. There are no boats on Cayo Santa Maria. And if he is foolish enough to swim, he'll either drown or be eaten by sharks. Whoever it is won't get far. His name is Dirk Pitt, and according to Velikov, he's the most dangerous of the lot." "Dangerous or not?" Polovoy waved him to silence and began pacing the carpet, his face reflecting deep agitation. "We cannot afford the unexpected. The deadline for our Cuban adventure must be moved up a week." Maisky shook his head in disagreement. "The ships would never reach Havana in time. Also, we can't change the dates of the celebration. Fidel and every high-ranking member of his government will be on hand for the speech-making. The wheels of the explosion are set in motion. Nothing can be done to alter the timing. Rum and cola must either be called off or continue as scheduled." Polovoy clasped and unclasped his hands in an agony of indecision. "Rum and cola, a stupid name for an operation of such magnitude. Another reason to push on. Our disinformation program has already begun spreading rumors of a CIA plot to launch devastation in Cuba. The phrase rum and cola is patently American. No foreign government would suspect it as being hatched in Moscow." Polovoy shrugged in assent. "Very well, but I don't want to think about the consequences if this Pitt fellow by some miracle survives and makes it back to the United States." "He is already dead," Maisky announced boldly. "I am sure of it."